Lot of confidence in that verse, don't you? I know whom I have believed. I'm persuaded. I'm persuaded that he's able to keep me, aren't you?
Yes.
I'm convinced. I'm convinced of it. We're in Psalm chapter 55, and you have a sheet that we handed out to you. And what we're going to do is walk through the verses together and hopefully in some way work on our skills of meditation. It couldn't hurt, right? Oftentimes in Psalm, when you and I come to the Psalm, we come with our preconceived thoughts and our preconceived, I would say, emotions. And because of that, we begin to translate it according to our perceptions of what it's saying rather than what it is saying. So Psalms were meant to be reflected upon. They were meant to be meditated on. And more specifically, God wants us to think through these things. And it is through the exercise of not leaving the text too soon that God begins to reveal things to us that we wouldn't normally see about ourselves. Once again, we have preconceived notions about even the emotions that we have. And there's a perception at times, for instance, a person may think that their main problem is that they're just feeling sad and depressed. And scripture may reveal more the heart of the matter is you're just angry about something. So, you know, the wonderful thing about scripture is that if you'll hang on tenaciously, God will begin to teach you something that you've never seen before. And, you know, as you look at the beginning or the title of the passage, it talks about a maskil of David. And really the inference of that is that it's didactic and that it's there to teach you something. So the point of each psalm is teaching us something. And we know that the psalm is about emotions. So it's teaching us something about the emotions that we struggle with and the things that we go through. And the particular instrument that is actually mentioned within this particular passage makes reference to an instrument that purposely sounds almost like it's expressing a derision. So you're going to hear in the psalm, you know, a sense of disdain and ridicule and hatred for something. And in the end result, that instrument is maybe even going to be pointing at us. So that's a wonderful thing about because, you know, as you go back to Psalm 19, what does he say? That, you know, what scripture does is it actually begins to reveal hidden things, my hidden faults. And, you know, it restores, you know, this soul. We need restoration. And there are things that are bothering us, oftentimes things that we've suppressed that we haven't been honest about. But just getting in the psalm, he begins to say, okay, you're not being honest about that. Let's get that out because you realize how damaging it is to you in holding these things on. So we're going to start by understanding the passage, and really the setting of it seems to keep putting much of his emotions back to that time of Absalom, his son, and the betrayal of his son, as well as other individuals that were betraying him in that. It doesn't specify who it was, but we know it's during that particular time and the struggles that he's going through. We know that this particular psalm is dealing with betrayal and the betrayal of a close friend. He's gonna make mention of this as we go, but just to kind of set you off and at least help you know where we're heading, that's what he begins to deal with. When we go through this psalm, what we're going to do, and what I've done, is I've asked you questions all along the way. So beginning with the first two verses, we're going to be dealing with specific questions. And I'm just going to ask you to maybe, let's think through this, and let's ask ourselves, well, why is he doing this? Now, the reason why I'm doing this is to hopefully encourage you to, when you're reading the psalm, to be asking questions, because he's telling you something, and you should be asking, well, why is he telling me that? Why is this so important for me to understand? And so you're going to see, hopefully, some of the questions that we're throwing out there. But the purpose of the questions is to help you meditate. So it's not like, I don't want you to think of it in terms of a, of a formula, but more specifically as, this is a way to think about this. This is to think, the way to muse over, it's a way to really reveal certain things in my heart as I begin to allow the Word of God to cleanse me as well as restore me and point me in the right direction. By keeping, you're going to see in almost every psalm there are these promises as well, and he's going to say, okay, you do this, this is going to happen. And, I was talking to Bobby before the service, and I says, have you ever cashed in on a promise? Because you think about it, you have all these promises in Scripture, and he goes, why don't you just cash them in? And you see many of the promises in which the psalmist goes, I'm banking on this. So you turn them into God, and you said this. And he goes, yeah, you taste and see that the Lord is good. Just try it. You'll like it. Mm-hmm. So you begin to realize just the faithfulness of God as you begin to really put these things to practice in your life. So we're going to start off and chime in, raise your hand, so we're not tripping over each other. But let's just talk about it and ask what's going on within the passage. He starts off in chapter 55 and verse 1. We're just going to look at the first two verses to begin with. He cries out, give ear to my prayer, O God, and do not hide thyself from my supplication. Give heed to me and answer me. I am restless and my complaint, and I am surely distracted in this. The question that I have at the very top is, what is he asking of God within these first two verses? What would you say, Dave? What would you say?
Ask him to hear his prayer and to do something about it. Put it in modern
vernacular. One of the statements that he makes, or a question that he is a request that he gives, is "Do not hide thyself from my supplication." That's a pretty strange thing. Well, I can't even picture God hiding himself. So. So he wants God to hear him, and he wants him to give heed, and he needs an answer, is what he's saying. But why does he feel that he has to ask God of this? Yes?
Do you think he might be holding and harboring some unconfessed sin, and he's not ready to let go of it?
It could be.
He thinks that God may be, he knows how God thinks.
Right.
I know he knows that I need to be right with you, God, before I can even get my prayer answered.
But he's not even sure he knows how to get right.
Well, that's why I brought up, is there a possibility he may have some unconfessed sin?
Yeah. Maybe
he's got some direction he's not wanting to go.
Yeah, well, that may be true, too. And like you said, maybe just a sense of, okay, I know maybe at this juncture you may not even feel like I need to be listened to, but please listen to me. So, yes. Yeah.
Because you get so emotionally overwhelmed or involved, you just can't even make sense of the situation.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. He actually says it at the end of verse 2, I am restless in my complaint, and I am surely distracted. The word that he uses in his complaint is actually, I think it's in Genesis chapter 2, verse 5, it is actually the same word for shrub, a bush. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? Because in the Hebrew way of thinking, a complaint is kind of like this tangled bush. You look at a bush and you have all these branches that are kind of tangled. You have all these kind of thoughts that come out of this one thing. And so they said, they might be, I'm wrestling with this thought. And they go, yeah, a bush. So that when God comes to Moses in Exodus, he comes in a burning bush. Why? Because God is saying, I have all these thoughts about my people, and I'm conflicted about the fact that they're in affliction. And you say, well, why does the bush continue to burn and it doesn't burn up? He goes, because I'm not letting this go. I'm not letting this thought go. I mean, I'm going to hang on to this, and we're going to keep talking about this, Moses, till we get this clarified, because this is very important to me. So it's this bush is a picture of all these ideas and thoughts, and this is what we need to do, and we need to talk through this. And oftentimes it is kind of tangled up, and you know, it's hard to know where it's coming from. Actually, the bush in Exodus, in which God is talking to him, has a bunch of thorns in it. Actually, makes reference to a thorn bush. So you know, a lot of times our thoughts are very painful, and the concerns are very much entangled and very painful. So it's a very interesting picture, and something that he's really describing in this particular passage. And so there are times that we come to God and we're not really sure how to untangle all this. And in some way, I think he is asking, you know, be patient with me. Let me just kind of, sometimes we think that in order to pray to God, we have to have all of our ducks in a row, and we need to make sure that it's very clear to God so he doesn't misunderstand. And God goes, just bring your tangled bushes, you know. You know, and it's a wonderful thing to know that you can just start, and God helps you untangle them. And so he cries unto God, and he's asking him to do that. If you look with me in verse 3, it reads, because of the voice of the enemy, because of the pressure of the wicked, for they bring down trouble upon me, and in anger they bear grudge against me. So my question is, if you look at number 2, what reason does he give for being upset? He obviously is upset. What is his reason? And one of the ways that you know that perhaps in a particular passage he's dealing with a reason for something is he uses a word called because. So if you're ever wondering, how do I know that, you know, he's fully coming up with maybe a reason for something, it's because he has the word, well, because of this. So that just kind of makes sense, doesn't it? So what's the because in the text? What reason does he give for being upset? Enemy. And explain to me what the enemy is doing.
Pressuring.
Okay. Bringing trouble down upon him. You feel this pressure pushing him down and smashing him and crushing him. It's interesting because the word trouble in here, avan, is actually where we get the word idol. But the reason why we get the word idol from this is that it's making your life busy and you're wearing yourself out for nothing. So trouble is an interesting picture because things happen in our life and people do things and you find yourself so wrapped up in whatever this is that you've wasted a whole day being upset. And if someone were to ask you, what did you accomplish today? You go, nothing. But boy, am I tired. You know how you get really tired, you know? Stella, you're gonna say something.
Yes, everything you're going from 1, 2, and 3, I've been through it all.
Been there, done that.
Yes.
Okay.
Be still and wait. So Thessalonian means mind your own business, work with your hands. So I tell them all this. So don't drive me crazy. I'm already there. You know? But I've been through all three of them. So I think it's exciting because I'm seeing the rest.
Well, and what the psalm is going to do, and this is one of the reasons why we're going, 1, verse 1, verse 2, verse 3, is it's taking us on a journey. It's letting us know that look, we all wrestle with these kind of things. We bring our tangled webs before the Lord, but in so doing, he wants me to clarify what is it that's really bothering you. And you know, as you begin, and what you're going to see is at the very start, there are certain things he releases, but he doesn't release everything. But the more he talks, the more you begin to see. And this is one of the reasons why you need to sit down and talk to God. Because it's in the process of the conversation with him that your heart begins to be revealed. And the problem gets clarified as you go through. So he's upset. He's being pressured. He's being pushed down. It's creating a lot of useless exertion. He's putting a lot of energy in his frustration. And yes.
Well, and it seems like they won't let it go. They bear a grudge and they just, you know, okay, we agree to disagree. You know, you feel your way, but
yeah.
They just won't let it go.
Yeah. And the inference within the passage as well is they lay traps for me as well. So that bearing the grudge is also a laying of traps. And they just set me up. If they just leave me alone, but they're not leaving you alone. So, and for some reason you can't seem to leave it alone. So there you both sit in misery, and it seems like they're winning because you're frustrated and worn out. When you look at verse 4 and 5 in particular, he begins to talk about his emotions. And if you look at verse 4 and 5, my heart is in anguish within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. So he describes his emotions. He describes within the passage how he's feeling. How would you describe these emotions? If you were to put it, say, in your own words,
I run from the flesh.
Okay, well, let's not figure out what we're going to do yet. Let's just, what is he feeling? Let's just talk about what he's feeling.
Depression,
anguish.
He feels also that everything's falling apart.
It's falling apart.
It's like, and I was going to, if you don't mind me dovetailing back to the first verse or the verses that we were at before, you get this feeling that I just wish everybody would leave me alone because I don't want to go your path, but you're not going to be happy until you convince me to give off, you know, to give affirmation to what you're doing, or better yet, be a part of what you're doing.
Right.
And so then when you're here, coming into this right here, my heart is in anguish with me. It's almost like, what am I, you know, it's almost like it's a lonely time for him or something. You know, I'm all alone.
Anguish is really described in the Hebrew as being twisted. It's an interesting. We oftentimes say my stomach's all twisted in knots, but he's saying my heart's twisted.
Twisted in sorrow or twisted in that I can't make up my mind.
It seems to be twisted in anguish, sorrow and pain and hurt. He's been hurt. There's something that's hurt him deeply. Yes. Yeah, I get that picture of Dishonest John who tied. What was her name to the tracks? Penelope to the tracks. I agree with you. There's just if any of you would put it in your own words, maybe something that you would say, that's kind of what I experienced. This is how it felt to me. Well, how would you describe it? Yes, Kim.
Darkness.
Sorry, got my glasses on.
Maybe darkness.
Darkness. Yeah, within the passage, of course, he says in verse 5, horror has overwhelmed me, and it's that picture of covering me. It's actually covered over me, so I can't see anything. I can't, and feels trapped. It feels trapped within the passages, and likens it. Because they're not really dealing with a physical aspect here, but he likens it to the terrors of death. So that the emotional is so powerful, it's sucking them into, and we know that people have just out of sorrow died. I mean, the power of grief and sorrow can, I mean, sometimes you hear of a husband dying, and shortly after that wife dies, or vice versa. My dad was telling me 6 days later, you know, this spouse died. They were of good health, but just the sorrow and the loss of losing somebody. So, yeah, it gives a picture of this tremendous horror that has gripped them. It's hard to imagine that something could so grip you. It just takes you into the jaws of death, but that's kind of the picture.
So is that him saying he just feels like he wants to die?
Feels that he wants to die, probably feels that I don't know if there's a want, but it's more feels death upon him. Just the grief and the sorrow and the anguish and the pain. If you've ever been pained by something that somebody's done, that almost is worse than death, isn't it?
It is. It's worse than death, and you want to give up.
You just,
but you're fighting to stay going forward.
So
that was a good description. I felt punched in the gut.
You feel that way. It does. It does. It's just, I mean, what do you do? So whatever he's talking about here is so powerful that it's moving him. Are you going to say something?
I'm just thinking of the all-consuming. It just like a blanket covering you that you can't escape.
You can't. And like Kim was saying, it's like you can't escape the darkness. You can't get out of it. And for people that are claustrophobic, that means something even something more deep than that. But in verses 6 through 8, he seems to convey to us something that he longs to do. And so instead of me just reading it, I'm going to let you kind of read it and share with me, what is he longing to do? He longs to do something. I mean, what would you long to do? If a sorrow overwhelmed you, trapped you, overwhelmed you, yes.
Go away.
Go away. Just go away. Fly away.
A mountain, a river, a lake, somewhere quiet. Nothing's gonna talk.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I think sometimes it's a statement when we're going through some emotional battles, spiritual battles. Sometimes a thought. I'm ready to go home. I don't even want to deal with this kind of stuff anymore. I'm ready to go home. Take me home.
Yeah, it's interesting. He doesn't say, give me wings of an eagle.
Right.
What does he want wings of?
Just the dove, right?
Yeah. I just want some peace.
I think for a lot of us as Christians, sometimes the thought is, Lord, I'm just ready to go home. I'm done fighting. I don't have anything left. Yeah. And I think there's times, too, where we're honest with ourselves. This battle that's going on, I don't have much more of this I can take.
Yeah.
And it's usually in those moments that I'll usually hear something like, we're not done.
We're not done, yeah.
We're not done.
There's a
place of refuge.
In the passage, oh, that I had wings like a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. That's not the word shalom, but it is a word that makes reference to a permanent place of abiding. In other words, I want to fly away, and I don't want to ever come back. So that's that interesting picture that, yeah, I want to get out of here. Yeah, I don't want to be here anymore. He seems to convey, behold, I would wander far away. I would lodge in the wilderness. I would hasten to my place of escape, would actually be the word that he's using here, from the stormy wind and the tempest. So what is he trying to get away from?
The turmoil and upset that comes with these people.
Seems to be an evil he's trying to run from.
Yeah. Because if you think about it, I mean, whatever the stormy wind is, whatever the tempest is, it's stirring him up. and it's not letting him rest. He just can't, he can't stop thinking about it. He can't find any kind of solace. He can't find any kind of comfort. It just, get me out of this place. And it, you know, as much as we would like to think that it would be a place and you could just leave, it isn't. It's here. It's in our heart. We can't seem to get rid of it. Yes. He's a good one.
How he was feeling about his home, his people, the destruction that was going on.
Yeah.
And God tells him, I want you to go north. And he says, I'm going south. You know, are right. You watching what's going on here? I ain't going north. And just him, for that same, and all the emotions you were just talking about, and how it's pictured with Jonah, and, you know, the jumbled up the bush of emotions, and him just saying, I want to get away.
You know, your emotions are just one of those things that you just can't seem to get away from. They so haunt you that you just can't seem to find any kind of peace or rest from it. In verse 9, he wants God to do something. What does he want God to do? Confuse, O Lord, divide their tongues, for I have seen violence and strife in the city. So he wants to confuse. So the best way I could put that, because there's just kind of a kind of Hebrew vernacular within this, but basically what he's saying is that confuse actually has the sense of, don't give them any breathing room. Right. But more specifically, what he's basically saying is, don't let anything they say be effective towards me in any way. So the dividing of the tongue, let them be hitting each other instead of me, but don't let it be effective. And a sense of taking away the effectiveness, taking away the breath, so to speak, that would cause the tempest in my life and cause the turmoil. Don't let them have any effect on me. And that seems to be a legitimate prayer. I mean, you know, something happens and someone has sort of stirred it in our lives and you can't seem to get it out of your head, and you're saying, God, stop the effect. You know, I don't want it to have an effect in my life.
Would that be don't take into account a wrong suffered?
It would seem to go more from the realm of don't let me feel the effects of what they're saying. Because when somebody that we care for does something that hurts, how do you not hurt? How do you not feel that? How do you stop thinking about it? How do you get out of here? And we're going to see that to be true. We haven't gotten that far yet, but we're going to see that to be true.
Because in verse 3, it says, because of the pressure of the wicked.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, you had said that the wicked are those who do not believe in God. So would this be...
hostile towards... Actually, Rasha is hostile towards God. The wicked are hostile towards God.
Hostile towards God, anybody else who's not hostile with them.
Right. So if you were to describe and take, if you take verse 9 and you take verse 10 and 11, then you kind of put them together. Does he seem to have a beef with somebody in particular? I mean, are we starting to get some clarification about who it is that he seems to be upset about?
People dwelling in the city.
people dwelling is pretty interesting. In the city, it kind of brings us out of nowhere. In the city. And then he used another word like walls. That's pretty interesting, too. I mean, where did this come from? I don't even know where it came from. But he seems to be pointing more towards, the pronouns that he's going to start using are going to be more descriptive of the city than it is of an individual. If you were to describe, according to verse 9, 10, 11, who he has a beef with, who is it, or what is it?
Everything.
Okay. Yeah, that pretty well covers it. Can't go wrong with that.
Characteristic of the city.
Okay, yeah. Isaiah would make reference to that. Okay.
It's a disconnect from each other. It's a impersonal.
City always has the inference of you've built something to protect you. It will oftentimes be used with walls because that's your sense of security. And it's man building these walls and this sense of security. He seems to have a beef with that. As we've been talking about Babylon, which is the personification of that, there's this picture of, once you build the walls big enough, you go, well, I am Babylon and nobody can touch me. You know, and there's this arrogance that comes along with it. It is very much about that, yeah. I mean, here again, you go back to the Tower of Babel. They built the tower and they built the city. Now, one is the exaltation of man. The other is making reference to nobody's going to touch me because I already built the walls. And in almost every case, the city is literally translated fortress or walls. So there's a fortress there. It seems as if in this sense of I'm going to protect myself, it creates a hostility that hurts and destroys others. And so he's felt a part of this within this passage. When you come to verses 12 through 14, he seems to be expressing at this point, a greater intensity, it seems to get more personal. So if you were to look at 12 through 14, what is it you would say, why does he seem to feel so strongly about whatever's going on? Yes, Sonny.
That goes against what he feels is the more righter way to go in pursuits. You know, you can walk away from the disgust and the evil of what mankind wants to do, but then when you've got someone that's close to you, you had fellowship with them, and then they try to balance out, bridge it somehow or another, and say, hey, I'm kind of speaking kind of like in layman terms here, can't we kind of get along with them? Still get along too,
right?
That's a difficult thing.
You can't. It doesn't seem to bother you as much if it's a stranger, but once it's somebody that it's a good friend, somebody you love, somebody you care for. Now it's personal, and anytime it's personal, and I think it's one of the things that the passage is revealing to us. Anytime it becomes personal, the emotions grow exponentially. Because up to this point, you go, look, I could deal with it if it was some guy that just hated me, said he hated me, fine, I hate you too, have a nice day. But the fact that he describes this individual. How does he describe this individual?
Companion.
Someone that's very close.
Yeah, it's yeah, I mean the way that he, but it is you, a man of my equal. Here again, if I could just put this in more just regular language, it would just basically be somebody so much like me. I mean, we were just alike. We got along so well. I mean, how could it be that somebody that was so close to me at one time, and then he uses the phrase a companion, which seems to make a specific focus on, this is somebody I confided with. You know, we talked about things that, you know, you don't normally talk to everybody about. I mean, this is someone that we got deep about, and he uses the phrase familiar friend. We knew each other. He uses yada, which makes reference to the fact that we really knew each other. You know, you start a sentence and the other person's kind of finishing it, and it's like it's like we went to church together, for crying in a bucket. I mean, we had fellowship together. The word fellowship actually has a picture of just laying down on a couch. Actually, it has the word couch in it, and you're just kind of laying around and we're just enjoying the conversation. And what happened? You know, so something has so happened that. Somebody so close seemed to, so he feels obviously very strongly about this because of the relationship. What comes out of this that wasn't in verse 3, I mean, verse 3, he talks about the voice of my enemy, pressures of the wicked, but now he goes, okay, what I didn't tell you was it's personal. It was my friend. So, okay, wow. Now, you know, up to this point, I mean, what did he want God to do? Confuse, O Lord, divide their tongues. Now, if you look in verse 15, what does he want God to do? Let death come deceitfully upon them. Let them go down alive to Sheol, for evil's in the dwelling and in their midst. I mean, you can feel it getting intensified. You know, you start off talking to God and you're saying, I'm a little upset about this. You know, you talk to him long enough and you go, I'm want to kill him. And so God goes, we're making progress. So you can feel him getting, you know, working through these things and getting through. So in his reflection on the wrong that was perpetrated upon him personally, as you look in verses 12 through 14, what does it seem like he wants God to do?
To solve it, but not to destroy.
Well, let death come deceitfully upon them. Now, what's strange about this? And just to kind of throw, you were going to say something.
I wonder if he's wishing, wanting them to feel the same pain he's feeling.
Some of their own medicine. You lied to me. You're disloyal to me. You know, it's sort of like God with Hosea. You know, your loyalty is like the dew on the grass. You know, as soon as that sun comes up, a little heat on the relationship, and poof, you're gone. You know, you're out of here. And you know, God says, you know, I desire loyalty rather than sacrifice. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's hardly anything that hurts more than disloyalty. And one of the reasons why, when you consider the law, if you murdered somebody, a life for a life, right? If you committed adultery, it was a life for adultery. What Scripture is saying is that deception hurts as much as death. And so the pain that comes in out of this, and I mean, you really see that being, in fact, in many cases, more than death. Because at least death is a finality and you're over with it, and this just keeps seeming to haunt and... and to bring more and greater pain.
So 15, he's so angry, he's just like, take him out?
Well, and here's the interesting point that I was bringing about. If you back up into verse 13, but it is you, a man of my ankle. That's a singular pronoun. Then he goes into verse 15, let death come deceitfully upon. Now we're dealing with a plural again. This is very interesting, his shifting, which...
So is that almost like as if two things come to mind? Is he bringing this before God in a way of appealing that let them be dealt with so my companion can come around or something? And then on top of that is another question of mine, is he dealing with those that are of the evil? It'd be better for them to go down to Sheol or whatever instead of causing another one's companion or friend to stumble or fall.
You could say that. Of course, Sheol almost in every case, I think King James wrongly translates hell. But Sheol is always making reference to a nether world or the place of death.
Right.
So he's not necessarily wishing them to hell, but he is saying, you know, I want this to be over with, and I don't want them to do any more damage. The them seems to be that he's going back to the city. Where they opens up and they go in a shield. Right.
Is he in any way tying it to...
He could be. He could. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it wouldn't be a stretch. I mean, he'd be familiar with the text that he, you know, that picture would be in his head.
Would it be like, you know, vindicate me like you did?
Yeah.
I guess my question is, what does he want to go away? That's the question, because it's in the plural. And I think, like Josh is saying, the influence of the city, he feels that somewhere along the line, this friend of his has been, I mean, something pulled his friend away. Something caused his friend to abandon him. And yes, he's tremendously hurt by what his friend does, but it's almost as if he can't wish him dead. But he can wish the influence dead,
yes,
so to speak.
As you said in the beginning, that this was around the time of Absalom, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that's what it's, you know, thinking from a parent perspective, how much,
yeah,
like, we don't want.
That.
Yeah.
It's like somebody else has done this.
Yeah, it can't be the kid.
Yeah,
it's my kid,
yeah.
You know, so somebody got to him. And he just so is angry at that force that caused this to happen, you know.
All that influence.
Yeah, there's.
Everywhere.
Yeah, so okay, so he says in if you look in verse 16 and 17, there's something that he seems to at this juncture that he's purposely to do. I'm going to do this. This is what I'm going to do. Now we know what he wants to do. He's already said what he wants. I want to fly away. I want to get out of here. I don't want to ever come back. I don't want to deal with it. But he knows that there is no such place. So he makes a resolve. What's the resolve? What's he going to do? Okay, he's gonna call on God. He's just going to, yeah, we're going to talk this thing out. Here again, you have that tangled bush. We're going to talk this thing out, and I'm not letting go. It's going to be day and night, maybe. We're just not going to not take care of this. I'm just going to stay here. And he uses that, I will complain, and I'm going to murmur. And he seems to be confident about something. What does he seem to be confident about? Yeah, he's going to hear my voice. He's confident, and he seems to be not only confident that he's going to hear, but according to verse 18, what does he seem to be confident about? Yeah, the guy's got a, there's going to be a redemption there. We're going to skip verses 18 through 21. We're going to drop on down to verse 22 and 23. And he seems to give advice to us. So in the end of this psalm, he's given us some advice. He's talking to us, and he says to us, cast your burden upon the Lord. It sounded like Peter may have quoted this, right? So, the casting. Now, we'll kind of find out where he gets this from, but it's basically to throw off this thing that, what is this thing that he kind of has, if we were to call it a monkey on his back or something, what is this thing that's weighing him down, that's pressuring him, that pushing him down? What is this thing that he has to cast off? Because when you think of just to make an interesting point here, cast your burden upon the Lord. A burden was, according to this particular text, is something that somebody else had put on you. So somebody had put something on him. He feels weighed down. He feels pressured. You know, stop, enough, you know. And he can't seem to get it off him.
Men of deceit and bloodshed.
Pardon me?
Men of deceit and bloodshed.
Okay, so, So he's trying to get the men that are on his back. It's the bad guys that he's trying to get off.
I mean, you got to bring them down to
go
the
get them, you know, get them off my back.
Trouble that comes from them is, even though you have tried to abstain from doing whatever you can to stay away, they are burdensome because they're constantly before you, as the beginning of the chapter says, weighing you down. And so there comes a place in time where that weighing down is either going to weigh you down to where you die, or you're going to lift that burden up before God and say, you know what, God, this is yours. And I just need to make sure I stay righteous before you. And I do the right thing.
Okay, so let's define the burden. What is the burden?
The hurt.
Right.
I'm
just
going to
say, when I read this, I think of there's been a misplaced trust. You said the word evil is a van, and I think of idols. And so we make people in our lives idols, and we put all this hope and trust in them, and then they disappoint us because they hurt, they do whatever. We tend to forget we have the capacity to do things like that.
Right. Right.
One is good, and that is you, not anyone else. Not me, and not this other person.
Yeah. Okay, so, okay.
Would it be far to say that the burden is the culture and the people in the city who are drawing his loved ones away, or this person who's so close to him?
Yeah, I don't know if you can actually say that the burden is the people. There's something else that's weighing him down. Yes, Kim.
Is it how he's responding?
It's how he's responding. Because you have to remember, he's in labor, right? He's working for nothing. He comes to the end of the day, and he's struggling, and he's sweating, and he's worn out. And what did you do? I sat at the couch and, you know, ate potato chips and watched TV all day long. But he didn't accomplish anything because he was just, you know, so depressed.
Well, he was so shocked. I mean, in the church, mind you, my best friend, and then everybody's turned against you because
right.
was in shock.
Right.
I mean, very much.
Yes. Go ahead, Kim. Yeah. You can't stop. You can't stop thinking about it. Yeah. Yeah. So his advice is, throw it off. And God's going to use the word sustain. God's going to equip you to defend your position. Is actually seemingly what he's saying. And he will never allow the righteous to be shaken, but thou, O God, will bring them, there he goes in the plural, down to the pit of destruction, men of bloodshed and deceit. And once again, there seems to be a parallel, bloodshed and deceit, like the same thing. You know, men of bloodshed and deceit will not live out half their days, but I will trust in you. So he's the inference obviously is you need to trust in God. Okay, so we left out some verses, and I want us to go back to those verses, verses 18 through 21. And as we look at, in particular, 18, he says, he will redeem my soul in peace. You don't usually see that kind of phrase that is worded in this way. He's actually going to padah, redeem. He's going to release me from this prison that I'm in. Now, he's in a kind of prison, right? What's the prison? Yeah, he's working for nothing. He can't get this out of his head. He can't get out of this place. He can't find freedom. We wish he could fly away. He can't even move. Yeah, he's overwhelmed by this blanket of depression, and he needs somebody to get him out of this. And so he somehow believes that as he calls upon the Lord, somehow God's going to release him and set him free and finally bring him to what? Peace. Okay, so he wants to fly away like a dove. So what is he looking for? Okay, he's got to give me some peace in all of this. So he's crying for peace. And peace from what, does he say? Okay, what's the battle? Okay, what's the burden?
His response. The way he's responding.
Okay, the way he's responding. That's the burden. The fact that he can't seem to get out of this sorrow. He can't seem to get out of this stupor that he's in. He can't find freedom. So there's this battle, and there seems to be a battle which is against him, a battle for his emotions. Who's winning? Well, the other guy is. The bad guy's winning. Because he can't seem to get out of this. How many are there? Verse 18. Too many. Too many. I can't. You know, it never ends. Have you ever found yourself getting, okay, finally I got that thought out of my mind, and another one comes in. And, you know, it's like you see the jets, you know, they're just lining up. And the other one's taken off as soon as that one, and it just never stopped. So there are too many that strive with me. And I know that God will hear and answer them. His point is that God's not sitting idly by and not perceiving what they're saying or doing. That God is actually taking note of what they are doing. And it says, even, if you look at verse 19, even the one who sits enthroned from of old. Some actually perceive that this is not talking about God. This is talking about somebody that seems to be sitting in a position that is very confident, and they haven't been moved. It's kind of like the Moabites, you know. They're sitting on their leaves. They've never been changed. There's just never been a problem. And their confidence is in the fact that, okay, so what's going to happen? Nothing's ever changed, so I've always been in control. I've always been. And there are things that happen in our life that not only are overwhelming to us, but we almost instantly take defeat in the sense that it's never been different. It's always been this way. And almost immediately our thought is, then it can't change, you know, because it's always been this way. This person has always done this. They've always responded in this way, and they've always seemed to come out on top. They sit enthroned. They're in control, and they seem to have a sense of confidence, and even in many cases, the respect of others by virtue of winning. But even the one who sits enthroned from of old, with whom there seems to be no change, and they don't fear God. So everything's okay. Kind of like that, like I said, Jeremiah 48:11 is basically undisturbed. How does this person who has never been touched and seemed to be getting away with murder, and once again, I think we're dealing more with just a him than we are with just a world thing. He has put forth his hands against those who were at peace with him, people that weren't doing any harm, that they were just wanting to help, and then he attacked them. So it shows that that he looks lightly upon, if you look at the end of verse 20, he looks lightly upon any kind of promise. He profanes it and thinks of a promise, you promised that you were going to help. You promised that you would be here. You promised that you were going to be my friend. Oh, really? Did I promise that? All right, I didn't mean it. And you're going, how can somebody say that? You're almost taken back by the fact that there's such a cavalier attitude. And he says, his speech, verse 21, was what? Smoother than butter, but his heart was war. He was planning killing me. Smooth talker. His words are softer than oil, and yet they were drawn swords, everything that was going on. If you back up into verse 18, I just want to reiterate. What is he believing God to do? Set him free. Verse 22. What does he say that you and I need to do? Throw it off. There's almost a sense of, he's already loosened your chains. All you have to do is throw them off. Because he's done that. He's heard your cry. He's going to save you because you came to him. Now, there's a key in all of this. And that's the point that I don't want you to miss. Because when he talks about the men of bloodshed and or more specifically the men of deceit, which are the ones that, it's just like they're murderers. They're killing you. They're killing your soul. They're killing, your life. They're sucking literally the life out of you. It's like you're living in death, so to speak. It says, men of bloodshed and deceit will not live out half their days. He's trying to tell you something. What is he telling you?
Stop responding the way you are, or your life will be
cut short. Cut short. Why?
Because you're not trusting the Lord.
Yes. Sort of.
7:7.
Pardon me?
Ecclesiastes 7:7.
Okay, what is that?
The excessively wicked will die young.
Okay, that's a part of it. But if you could nail what it is that shortens life. Because we're all very life conscious here. So we all want to live longer.
Well, there is no life below, and there is life above.
What is it that will cut your life? Were you saying something, Josh?
Dishonoring,
okay.
Dishonoring your parents.
There you go. Okay. We're gonna pull from Exodus. We're gonna pull it out another passage. But if we were to stay in this passage, yes. And what's the treachery of the passage? Deceit. Deceit will shorten your life. That's the question. See, this is the point. This is the point. Their deception is killing people. You're letting it kill. Why? Why? Because you're not being truthful.
No.
What's the truth? God cares for you. Call unto me and I will answer you. I'll show you great and mighty things. We read in Jeremiah, but we've been reading in the Psalms. Come to me. Talk to me. Call on me. He has the confidence. As for me, I shall call upon the Lord and he will save me. Now that's the truth.
Yes.
That's the truth. But if we don't do it, then we're lying to ourselves. And the frustration of people that are godly is that they're not being real about their faith. They're talking about the fact that, look, I can talk to God about anything and everything. And God goes, yeah, but are you going to believe the truth? The truth is that these guys that are doing what they're doing aren't getting away with anything. That's the truth. And the truth is that I care for you. Peter will actually use this text, casting all your cares upon him for?
He cares for you.
Yeah, that's the way Peter will quote the text. See? But if you're living in deception, it'll take your life. I've seen many a believer that have said throughout their church goings, oh, I believe. And I watch them bite their nails and I watch them, fidget and worry and, pace the floors, and I'm going, they don't believe. And you wonder, why are they having heart attacks and why are these problems coming out of their, bodies? I mean, your body is actually telling you the thing in psychology, body language. Well, your body is saying something. You may lie. Your body's not lying. And the things that will shorten your life is the deception. You're not being real about your faith. And he's coming to us, and he says, if you'll throw it to him, if you'll cast this off, then you can know that you will never, never be shaken. But that's the evidence that you're not lying to yourself. I mean, if in fact you're disturbed, I mean, he starts off going, I'm going crazy here. And God goes, I know, you're not being truthful. Well, I trust you. No, you don't. That's why you're shaking. Yes, you're going to.
Is this not the admonition in Romans 12?
Hmm? Yeah, especially as you come to the end of chapter 12. Look, you have to believe that God is the one that does the vindication and that he's going to do right. And if you don't believe that, then yeah, you're going to be worried and upset and fearful. If you're going around angry, I mean, anger will kill you. You hold on to your anger, it will kill you. Your anxiety will kill you. You will not live long. Yes. That's his promise.
Hold on to his promises.
Right.
And that's where your peace will
come. And he says you'll never be shaken. So when he says the righteous will be never be shaken, who are the righteous? Well, okay, you have to understand, he's actually not only paralleling, but he's doing a contrast. So what's the contrast? Deception. That's the wicked. Truth is the righteous. So within the text, the righteous are the ones that are being truthful about what is and who is true.
Yes. It was Isaiah 54:17. I said Romans, I'm sorry.
That's okay. We'll take it either way. We know it came out of the Bible. And it's just good to know that when we get serious about our faith, we have nothing to fear. And the confidence and the peace that passes all understanding, as Philippians 4 says, be anxious for nothing, but when you have an issue, talk to God about it, and then when that happens and you literally give it to him, how do you know that you gave it to him? It says the God of peace will be with you. He never leaves you. So that the wicked are like the tossing sea. They cannot be quiet. They just, And who are the wicked? They're the ones that don't believe. They tell God, they're deceptive towards God. See, they're lying towards God. We get so upset because people have, you lied to me. You said you were going to be with me, and you didn't. And God says, okay, so you said you were going to trust in me, and you didn't. See, we don't think of us being the ones that are causing the treachery. We can nail it when somebody else does it to us, but when we're not really trusting in God. The psalm is full of, I'm trusting in God, I'm trusting in God, I'm trusting in God. He finally comes to the point and he goes, I'm really worried here. And God says, you're not being loyal to me. It's an act of disloyalty. So the wonderful thing is that we can be free. Father, thank you for the freedom that you grant us as we cast all of our cares upon you. And we actually believe that you care for us. And it's done. It's good. And you've got this. I mean, the world is a very mean and wicked place. And it's causing people to do things that they never should. And it causes people to not be true. But we're going to be true. When we tell you that we love you, we love you. And when we say we're going to trust you, we're going to trust you. We're going to do that. I give you thanks in Jesus' name.